is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. It's a great honor.
News for your soul. Life-changing broadcasts to souls around the world since January 1997. Call in to live News for the Soul shows daily for intuitive coaching, readings, numerology, leading-edge health information, and much, much more with featured hosts from around the world. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Next on News for the Soul Radio, it's time for Perfectly Holistic with Pam. Pam is a cat mom and holistic health seeker who, after suffering an injury that wouldn't heal, was led on a journey to seek out alternative, holistic and natural medicine. She now shares what she learned, helping people and their cats along their path to holistic health. Pam has taken courses in holistic health for animals, muscle testing, and animal communication. Please welcome Pam back to News for the Soul.
Happy Monday, everybody. This is Pam with Perfectly Holistic. I hope everybody's had a wonderful day. It's a fantastic evening to be chatting about cats. And I am super, super excited, can you tell, to have a really special guest with me tonight who I heard about a few years back from one of my very special mentors, Dr. Karen Becker, on one of her interviews. And I was always very keenly interested in what Dana was doing here in Texas at the time. And I'll let him talk about some of that tonight. But let me introduce my guest. So Daniel Orrego is one of the founders of Keto Pet Sanctuary, Epigenics Foundation, and Pause for Change, which advanced scientific inquiry in both canine and human models to better understand the intersection of metabolism and disease pursuant to addressing obesity, cardiac disease, diabetes, cognitive decline, and cancer. Additionally, Daniel has worked in research and development at Quest Nutrition, as well as his own companies in evaluating the use and implementation of novel ingredients, the biological impact of unique food substrates, and developing performance and therapeutic product lines for both scientific research and the general consumer. So welcome, Daniel. Thank you for joining me.
Indeed. Greetings and good evening. Good afternoon.
Yeah. You are just a wealth of knowledge, and I think our listeners are going to be super excited just to hear me pick your brain a little bit and just talk about stuff that you've learned that can help our pets and that is helping our pets and perhaps even people live longer, healthier lives. So where should we start?
Well, I mean, maybe it doesn't hurt to work backwards from just a point of departure by stating that I'm both a cat guy and a dog guy. I have both. And so I've maintained an interest in feline and canine companion pets really since I was a kid. And it's only really in the last 8 or 9 years that I've had an opportunity to do anything in the space that directly influences their well-being and their long-term health. So that's kind of the setup and background here.
Yeah, so it's personal. It's a personal mission for you then.
Very much so, to the extent that, you know, whenever you have the unique privilege and pleasure of having great canine or feline companions, you don't want those relationships to stop.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, the poetry of living is that that does stop at some time, at some point. But, you know, we want to extend those relationships for as long as possible. And so, as a result, my interest and my focus has really been, I think, as you mentioned before, really at the intersection of metabolism and disease, as influenced primarily by what the nutritional inputs are for cats and dogs over their lifespan, and ultimately how that can play a tremendously impactful role, and not just the length of their life, but also the quality of their life.
Exactly. So how did you get started in this journey?
Well, you know, you mentioned Quest Nutrition, and if, you know, if anyone's had a Quest protein bar, they're familiar with that brand and that company. And one of the things that came out of the success of that enterprise was trying to understand more deeply, firstly in humans, really, how nutrition can play a role in mediating disease processes, and then by extension, because, you know, the principals that I was working with shared the same passion that I do when it comes to feline and canine health, that we began to focus our energies on seeing if the same nutritional interventions that worked in humans, that worked, on the benchtop in the laboratory on mice and rats, could also bring benefit to cats and dogs.
Oh, that's cool. And I'm sure there is huge crossover.
Indeed. You know, I mean, that's what's kind of cool is that, you know, there are differences, of course, in physiology, but humans are not that far away from cats and dogs in mm-hmm. terms of how they respond to food and to pharmacology and to supplementation. And so there is a tremendous amount of crossover, and it's really bidirectional. You know, what we learn about humans, much of it can be applied to companion animals and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So go back to, well, let's start with Keto Pet Sanctuary. I know you were very, okay, here's the buzzword for the last several years has been keto diet. Everything's keto this, keto that. You can't go into a store without seeing some kind of a marketing ploy for keto diet and books coming out and all these different health people talking about keto diet and why everybody should be using it and why some people shouldn't and how it benefits and all. And I don't want to go into a full detailed discussion on keto diet because that would take hours, but I know that you were very instrumental in the Keto Pet Sanctuary here in Texas a few years back. So, and you were having amazing success. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Sure. Well, you know, what you're identifying and acknowledging there is that the marketing has kind of caught up to the science, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's nothing particularly new or novel about a ketogenic diet. It really started in about the 1920s, early 30s at Johns Hopkins University, and it was as recently as the early 90s, it became the standard of care for pediatric epilepsy. So for kids that had refractory epilepsy that didn't respond to normal drug therapeutic treatments, they found that instituting a state of what's called nutritional ketosis brought about this tremendous benefit of not only lowering the intensity of seizures, but also lowering the frequency of seizures. And it was very astute scientists like Dr. Thomas Seyfried who noticed that these same benefits could be applied to other disease processes like cancer, like diabetes, et cetera. And so I'm very interested as a working group to try to understand, okay, you know, the scientific literature is pretty deep when it comes to this, not perfect, but definitely compelling. And that was kind of the genesis of Keto Pet Sanctuary, was to say, hey, look, why don't we do some real world work and try to understand if we can help dogs and help dogs immaterial of what cancers they have. And so the focus there was to rescue dogs who would otherwise be euthanized because they have cancer and essentially use the same protocols that humans had already, you know, been exposed to on the dogs, obviously with some variation and adjustment for canines. But that was really the start of it and kind of the point of departure for seeing what we could understand and how much of what had you know, been successful in both the lab and in the real world in anecdotal cases could be applied to help dogs.
Sure. And the work that you did over there, you were able to replicate just by changing what the dogs were eating prior to coming to you, doing all of their, I guess, their labs and everything to see, you know, exactly where they were. And then y'all did very specific diets, ratios, timing, and all of that for these animals over there.
That's correct. I mean, and to sort of leap to the punchline, if you will, basically what we're doing was using a ketogenic diet to downregulate the availability of glucose substrate within the bodies of these dogs that have cancer. And all of that is sort of a fancy way of saying that we recognize that sort of the net benefit or the payload that's delivered when a dog or a cat or a human is in nutritional ketosis is that there is less sugar. Glucose is the same word for sugar. There's less sugar in the body, and we understand that sugar or glucose is the primary fuel substrate for tumor progression. And so
yes.
By virtue of using the diet, you lower that substrate. And what you observe is, in the best cases, you see cancer go away. In most cases, what you see is that the disease progression slows down dramatically. And in addition, what you see is that the overall health of the dog is upregulated tremendously. And so, you know, we were able to follow that using PET CT scans, doing very careful blood assays, and then all of the standard diagnostics that veterinarians use to assess not just the state of disease in a dog, but their overall health.
And you had a few cats there too, right?
We did. You know, the benefit of having a sanctuary like that is you do get surprises. And so sometimes cats would appear to us, and very often we would end up collaborating remotely with pet parents who say, hey, look, I know you guys are working on dogs, but I have a cat at home. You know, what can we do to address some of these challenges that come with disease? You know, cats get cancer too, and many of the same things that we found benefiting the dogs worked really, really well in cats also.
That's awesome. I mean, that's what every pet parent wants to hear, you know, because cancer is such a scary word to people because I think it just instills a lot of fear because there's so much misinformation and confusing information out there as to what people should do, shouldn't do, and especially when it comes to our pets, that's the last thing we want to be told, you know, to find out that our seemingly healthy pet who acts asymptomatic has tumors growing inside of them that we didn't know about. And at that point, you're really on a race to stop the progression as quickly as you can, if possible. And in some cases, it's already at stage 4 because it wasn't found quickly enough.
Yeah, well, you're touching on, you know, a key component here to just the, you know, sort of in broad strokes, what it takes to be the best steward that one can of a dog or cat's health over their lifetime. And, you know, it's a steep hill to climb because, you know, obviously there's an economic component to that. And then there's also an education component to it. And, you know, one of the things that's so great about companion animals is, you know, they're generally in a good disposition. So sometimes it's not obvious to a pet parent that there may be a disease process going on until, you know, very close to the end stage. And one of the things that we learned was that doing consistent imaging and consistent blood testing, particularly specialty blood tests that are very direct in assessing states of disease, is a phenomenal way to understand the health of your pet over time. And these are things that, you know, are sort of obvious to a large extent in the scientific literature, but aren't particularly part of the popular discourse, and often are not particularly part of the general practice of most veterinarians, unless they're specialists, unless they're oncologists, or, you know, unless they work in a specialty which focuses on specific disease processes. And so a lot of what we did was just share the idea that, you know, for example, getting annual ultrasounds of major organs is a fantastic way to spot check if anything's going on. You know, for the most part, it can be a non-invasive process, or only moderately invasive. And in addition, there are any number of specialty blood tests that can assess things like hemoglobin A1C, which, if elevated, is often an indicator, not a prognosticator, but an indicator of potential disease processes in play.
So when you and I originally talked, we talked a lot about how in a lot of veterinary clinics, there's just not – well, there's little to no education on nutrition other than what they sell out of a bag in their office, in their clinic.
Yep.
You know, and it's very frustrating. And we're seeing a trend of pet parents who are actually more educated about nutrition than vets. So vets are thinking, I need to get on the bandwagon here because there's a market I'm missing out on. At the same time, I don't see them being very, very educated. I see them going along with it. You know, but they're still recommending their prescription food, which is loaded with some of the stuff that causes and contributes to disease process. So it's very frustrating for integrative veterinarians and enlightened pet parents and people like us who have done a little research and been reading about this and listening and learning to experts for several years now preach how, you know, corn, wheat, and soy and all the other starches that they throw into processed pet food are not going to provide quality nutrition and can lead to things like your cancers and your diabetes and your inflammatory disease processes and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, you're again, you know, hitting on really what's a systemic challenge in not just small animal veterinary medicine, but also in human medicine, right? If you go to a human oncologist, if there's any focus on nutrition, typically it revolves around using nutrition to mitigate the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation, not so much nutrition as an intervention against the disease itself. And that really has a lot to do with the standard of care as it is practiced in a clinic. And so whether it's in human medicine or small animal veterinary medicine, you know, it becomes obvious that, you know, in general practice, sometimes in specialty practices it can go in a different direction, but in general practice, most of the time, physicians or veterinarians won't deviate from the standard of care. So either they don't have a lot to say about it, or even if they're knowledgeable, they may be hesitant to implement protocols that are outside of the standard of care. And that's where it becomes really incumbent upon the pet parent, at least for now, to be the best and most vocal and most passionate advocate on behalf of their companion animal to ensure that they're getting these things that can be very powerful, that can be very helpful to, you know, the dog or cat that they have at home that might be struggling with disease. And so, you know, I think to your point, it's going to take some time to transfer the knowledge that's in the research community into clinical practice. But the good news is there is hope for this in the sense that, you know, you mentioned Dr. Karen Becker earlier. She's been a phenomenal advocate for this and has done a lot of sort of nuts and bolts work on establishing what these protocols can look like and ultimately how they can function in a clinic. And there's others out there. She's not alone in this. And,
correct.
You know, it's slowly beginning to influence what veterinarians are allowing, you know, into their scope of practice, and that is good news. You know, obviously, yeah. if it can go a little faster, that's good also.
That's so true. I can sense that there's going to be an increase in demand for pet nutritionists who have gone through some of this research and can help independent companies who are already creating really good food and good diets, as well as I think you'll see more of those kind of people being sought out by pet parents that are trying to develop specific diets for their pet that has XYZ disease, don't you?
Well, you know, the great news is it's happening. You know, with all of the trials and tribulations that surround social media, there mm-hmm. are some good things that really bubble to the top. And you know, you're mentioning one of them. I mean, the community that has grown around just the concept, let alone the application and implementation, but just mm-hmm. the concept of fresh feeding for dogs and cats has exploded in mm-hmm. the last 6 years. You know, I remember I would hear a lot of echo when I would talk about these things 5 or 6 years ago. And now I hear voices that are responding and saying, yes, you know, this is something that not only is there an awareness of, but many, many pet parents are implementing this, sort of understanding at a very fundamental level that it probably, you know, just like for us, it probably makes sense to for dogs and cats to consume foods that are in alignment with, you know, the last 30 to 50,000 years of their evolution. Like, that's not a radical idea anymore. That resonates with a growing number of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it makes perfectly good sense because the industry, the processed food industry, has taken such a radical detour away from that in the name of convenience and cost-effectiveness.
Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong. In other words, it's not controversial to observe that, you know, agribusiness and industry is very focused on producing products that leverage the economies of scale within agribusiness and can, you know, essentially put on the shelf, if you will, products that are very cheap and affordable to pet parents. So that, you know, that's sort of there's nothing particularly controversial about observing that. I think where the conversation really gets interesting is to ask the question, well, yes, I think it's been well established that animals can survive on mm-hmm. eating those, but can they thrive? You know, one of the most alarming statistics that has come out, you know, really in the last 20 years is that, you know, back in the 70s, the average lifespan of a golden retriever was 17 years of life. Today, it's mm-hmm. around 11 years. And there's a lot of coefficients that impact that metric. It's not just nutrition. You know, it's breeding, it's genetics, it's environmental factors. But to understand that nutrition plays a major, if not a central role in that, is an important acknowledgement. And that's what's actually so inspiring, I think, about what's going on now, is that people are starting to grasp that and say, okay, well, maybe it's a little bit more inconvenient to prepare fresh foods for my pet or, for that matter, to buy them because they can be expensive. But people see the results. People can literally look at their dog on a week-to-week basis or their cat on a week-to-week basis and see not just physiological changes, but changes in behavior. And ultimately, if they're measuring changes in their lab work, changes in what imaging of major organs looks like. So it's not woo-woo by any stretch of the imagination. It's something that's empirical, and it's something that is measurable, most importantly.
Absolutely. Can you give our listeners some ideas of whether it's cases or examples of specific ways you guys have worked with different clients with different types of diseases?
Sure. So, you know, going back to cancer, you know, and there are some variations between tumor models, whether it's a mast cell tumor or hemangiosarcoma or an adenocarcinoma or osteosarcoma. What we see is really two things. One is when you pull out commercial pet food. In other words, and maybe we shouldn't paint with too broad a brush, but to be more specific, when we pull out high-carb, extruded, heat-processed foods, and we introduce fresh, high-protein, moderate-fat, very, very low to no-carb foods, just in dogs that, you know, are healthy, we see huge changes in physiology. In other words, they get leaner, they get more muscular. We see huge changes in lab work. Inflammatory markers go down dramatically. And oftentimes, you know, particularly with smaller dogs, we see pretty big changes in hemoglobin A1C. In dogs with disease, it's a little bit different. You tend to emphasize the fresh fats, moderate the protein, and keep the carbohydrate at zero. What we typically see is on imaging, we start to see more sharp definition of the tumor load in comparison to surrounding tissue. And then we see, again, a huge decline in inflammatory markers. And if you're doing consistent imaging, typically what you see is a slowdown in disease progression. And in cases where you catch it early and you have a light tumor load, that might be the only thing that's required. In cases that are more complex, there may still be a need for the standard of care. There may still be a need for chemotherapy and surgery and radiation. But what you find in those cases, because the nutrition is on point, that those standard of care interventions tend to work a little bit better.
Wow.
And the dog's quality of life improves. Now, these are general statements. Obviously, you have to look at each case on its own. But, you know, to sort of set the framework, those are the observations that we made on a case-to-case basis. And what's great about it is, unlike standard of care, where you really do need an oncologist as a partner, you know, pet parents, they're in control. They're the masters and commanders of what their dogs and cats eat at home. So they have a huge role to play in health and longevity as a result of that.
Correct. Now, as far as using that kind of fresh food with specific ratios of in sick pets, like the cancers and things like that, in the keto diet approach, your fat was a little bit higher, is that correct, than the normal?
That's correct. So just to set the table with that, there's a couple different ways that a human or a dog or a cat can get into ketosis. Probably the most abrupt way is to just cease all consumption. And for in humans and dogs, you know, within 72 hours of an absence of energy input, you start to see a decline in serum blood glucose and a slight rise in serum ketones. You know, that's not an approach that most people favor because it's not particularly comfortable. So you can produce the same effect by essentially pulling two major levers. The first lever is the caloric control lever. So by controlling calories very tightly, you're down regulating the overall energy input. So that's the first one. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is, to your point, the distribution of macronutrients. Why? Because by emphasizing fats, you're not only keeping down available glucose substrate, but you're also lowering the amount of glucose substrate that is produced through a process called gluconeogenesis, where fats and proteins can be turned into glucose. That process will occur because there's a basement, there's a threshold whereby certain tissues in the body require glucose. So that will always happen, and that will never stop. But by then you're emphasizing the fats, you're then very tightly controlling the proteins and essentially eliminating the carbohydrate, which is the primary source of glucose upregulation, now you're inducing nutritional ketosis in the same way that you would if you just ceased eating at all. So it's a way to essentially have a metabolic state still eating effectively. That's the long.
Now, it's a little bit more challenging to put cats into nutritional ketosis just because they can't, like, go for a couple days without eating like dogs can. Dogs can go for much, much longer, just like humans can go. So how did you help some of the cats that were in y'all's care at Keto Pet Sanctuary?
So you're absolutely right. And, you know, cats are just different than dogs in so many respects, and particularly from a nutrition standpoint. And so where dogs are, I think, in many respects, much more metabolically flexible, a little bit more care is required with the cats. And so what we would do is we would typically have a 2 to 3 week induction period where we would take whatever regular food that they were normally eating and on a gram-by-gram basis reduce that over – you know, a 10 to 20 day time span, and on a gram by gram basis, replace it with the fresh food in the correct ratios. And that length of transition seemed to accommodate them very well. And we really didn't have too many problems. If you try to do it any sooner than that, sometimes cats can run into a little trouble, or they do stop eating and then you have a problem. Sort of steady and slow wins the race with cats. And so we found that longer time horizon for cutting them over really worked a lot better. And sometimes it takes longer. You know, it all depends. I've worked with pet parents who did it over a process of 2 months. But eventually, you know, they would either, you know, check the glucose and ketones themselves, or they would go get the labs done and say, oh, yeah, they're there now. It took a little longer, but they're there now. And then you start seeing all those benefits come out in the blood work just in the same way that you would with a dog.
Right. And over time, did you guys see that the dogs or the cats, like, stayed in their – or that their disease process stopped or reversed? Did it come back if the diet was changed, or were they pretty good to go going forward with no further issues?
So there was a tremendous variance in what happened for a couple of reasons. In many instances when, you know, the dogs weren't with us at Keto Pet Sanctuary, if we were working remotely with somebody, you would see successes and setbacks, oftentimes because pet parents would go back to feeding the kibble. And had a couple cases where dogs were with us at Keto Pet Sanctuary for, you know, sometimes 6-7 months. They were doing very well. They would go back to the pet parents, and the pet parents would put them back on the old diet, and then problems. So that was one scenario. Another scenario, and probably the most interesting one, was that there were any number of dogs that lived a normal lifespan and remained on the diet, remained on the protocols, and still had cancer. You know, at the 6-month mark, annually, you do an image and you say, yep, it's still there. But it hadn't progressed. In other words, they had the disease, but it wasn't going anywhere. And that was really, really interesting to observe, because what it means is, at least in those cases, while the disease didn't go away, it was actually being successfully managed with that intervention. And so they lived normal lives. They could run. They could play. And as long as they remained on that nutritional program, plus, there were other things, supplementation, pharmacology, other things, they could live normally. And sometimes we see that in people as well, where you can see that there's still a little bit of disease load left. But when you go back and you do biopsies or you do PET CT scans, you see that, you know, on an annual basis, it's not really going anywhere. So that still constitutes a win. It's actually really interesting how those cancers can survive in sort of a suspended state. The other thing that we would see is that for dogs that had larger tumor loads that had to be debulked, and in some instances where chemotherapy was used, that their response to the chemotherapy was tremendous. And you'd see very, very rapid tumor shrinkage, but then no reperfusion. And so these were big victories for two reasons. One is the duration of chemotherapy that they had to endure was much shorter. Also, the dose that they had to endure was much less. And, you know, it's so often the case in with the use of chemotherapy, it can work very well for a period, and then everything comes back very aggressively. And we didn't see that. That was something else that was very compelling for us to observe, because it gave us some indication that really these combined, or what they call adjuvant therapies, might be the most powerful. Right, you sort of use nutrition as a central pillar and then titrate in these other modalities and get a better net effect from the totality of those combined treatments.
That's incredible. And I remember hearing over the last several years, several vets would talk about how their dog had cancer, or their a dog client would have cancer. But they didn't die from cancer. They died from old age, or they died from something else. So they were able to live with the disease, but they went on to have happy, healthy, happy, you know, active, normal lives through the rest of their lives. And I thought that was fascinating.
It is. It really is, because, you know, that, like I mentioned before, that's still a win, right?
Yeah.
In other words, if you're in a position where you're successfully managing disease progression, then yes, you still have to be respectful that there is a danger there, but that the animal can continue to live a fulfilling and joyful life is tremendous.
Right.
And so that's something that, you know, we've looked a lot more into. And, you know, one of the things that's tough in all of this is much of what we're discussing is anecdotal, and the prospective studies have yet to be done to really, you know, put the stamp of proof on this, but it does give you a clue that, you know, the sooner you start these things with your dog, the younger they are, the better chance you have of being in a better position to deal with disease at any point in life, right? There's no way that we can bulletproof ourselves or our dogs and cats from the slings and arrows of the world, but there are things that we can do to definitely give them a better chance, and that's really much of what we're focusing on now.
Well, and I totally agree with that, because I work with cat people all the time, and as I tell them, if they're not doing a healthy quality diet for their cat, I have to always remind people, and I'm always teaching, that foundation for cats is nutritional. If you don't have the nutritional part down for a cat that's biologically appropriate for a cat, you're already setting your cat up to develop the propensity to have health issues. So I think it's interesting what you just said, that, you know, how if the diet is foundationally correct, it's biologically appropriate for your pet, and something comes out of the blue and hits them, whether it's diabetes or seizures or cancer or, you know, things like that, it's so interesting how those steps of standards of care that they might choose, or chemo or nutraceuticals or whatever, how it seems to work better. And in the case of the pharmacology needs and things like that, if they don't have to use as much or as long, well, that's even better, because then you're putting less toxicity in the pet, you know?
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, what you're bringing up here is actually a great sort of framework for how to think about this. And, you know, I think this is something we touched on in a prior conversation, which is, if a pet parent asks themselves, you know, what did a dog or a cat eat for the last, say, 10,000 years, 20,000 years, mm-hmm. right? Well, it was definitely not an extruded sugar pellet. Right. I think that everyone can agree on that. And so what it does is it puts the onus on the advocates for or in favor of extruded sugar pellets to make the case that somehow that's a superior form of nutrition than something that more or less approximates, hopefully more, approximates what a dog or a cat would have eaten in the wild. And so that's sort of the spectrum, if you will. You know, on one side you have, commercial foods, and on the other side you have what a dog or cat would eat in the wild. If you're trending more towards what they would eat in the wild, it makes a pretty compelling case that that in all likelihood is serving them better. And the onus of proof and demonstration that somehow commercial foods are superior to that would have to be demonstrated. And as, you know, and if we go to the scientific literature, we see quite clearly that not only hasn't it, but that the likelihood that a compelling case could be made for that is not zero, but it's approaching zero. It's a steep hill to climb. It's a steep hill to climb.
Well, and that's what I also remind people, you know, if you look at cats in the wild, and I'm not talking about feral cats necessarily, but just cats in the wild, they don't die of cancer. They don't die of diabetes. They don't die of lymphoma. You know? they're just eating off the land and doing their normal wild cat thing, you know? And I think that's a good reminder for pet parents, cat parents, who ask themselves, how did my cat develop this problem? And you look at what they've been feeding them for the last 10 years, and you're like, well, I can pretty much say we could start here. You know, this didn't set them up very well, sadly. But cats are very resilient. Pets in general can be very resilient. And with just some effort, some focused effort on improving their nutrition, the very best way you can afford to do, can make huge differences in their health.
Yeah, I don't disagree, you know, and if you start with the simple things, right, if you start with just, and this is whatever you're feeding your cat or dog, even if it's a commercial food, simply by just controlling calories very tightly, that will serve them. The same is generally true of humans. There's always cohorts and, you know, Framingham style studies, very large studies, where you find a cohort, the data goes against the premise. But generally speaking, caloric control benefits just about every organism on the planet. So that's the big one, is controlling calories. But, and then the other one is to look at, okay, what is the distribution of macronutrients? Am I favoring high glycemic sugars, or am I favoring fresh proteins and fats, right? That's the second question to ask. And the thing that makes it tough is sometimes, you know, when you go to, you know, a big box pet store, it's not always easy to ascertain the answers to those questions, because, right, you know, every pet food you see basically says, hey, this is the best one. Some are higher priced, some are lower priced. But the great news is when you send these pet foods for lab testing, what you find is, you know, and you can do this, you can pick any one you want for the most part, but there are exceptions now, thankfully, that go away from this trend. But you can pick most of them, and what you'll find is that most of them are anywhere between 50 and 70% carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even in pet foods, and probably the person who's done the best work on this is Susan Fixton. Even with foods that have beef or chicken or salmon as the first ingredient, and there's an interesting labeling practice which allows a pet food manufacturer to count the raw weight of the meat, the fish or the beef or the chicken. They receive it, but the reality is, even though it's first on the label, it has been desiccated. So, as a percentage of the total spectrum of nutrition, it's actually much less than what's there in terms of carbohydrates. So, these are legal labeling practices. There's nothing illegal about them, but oftentimes these are little details that are not obvious to a consumer. And so knowing these things can help begin to, you know, offer deeper insight into what it is that one is actually spending money on behalf of their pets.
I totally agree. It's very frustrating because people don't realize when they see a particular pet food in the store on the aisles, and, you know, on the shelf, it's been sitting there for God knows how long because of all the preservatives in it. They turn it, the bag around, and it says the first ingredient is chicken. Oh, well, that sounds like a good food. But they don't understand that chicken doesn't necessarily mean chicken the way you and I think of chicken when we think a chicken breast, you know, and it's just very, very deceptive. And then if you look at the actual guaranteed analysis on some of those products, you see a protein percentage that the first three ingredients are corn and rice and, you know, soy. And then chicken or fish or, you know, meal or whatever. And so they artificially inflate the protein levels with these plant products that have a little bit of protein in it. And so it totally skews the whole reality of what's in the product. It's very frustrating.
Yeah. It is, and you're dropping down here to a very salient level of nuance, because there's two elements here. One is, you know, to your point, there can be products in there that might contain some protein, but not certainly not in the way that one would imagine when sees the marketing. There's, you know, fish and, you know, steaks on the label that look very appetizing. A difference, a very notable difference, and this is well understood in the industry. It's obviously not emphasized in marketing, but pet food is actually misnomered.
Yes.
It's actually pet feed, and there's a distinction. What is appropriate for farm and companion animals defined legally as feed because it is not appropriate for consumption by humans. And so this is very important distinction. And again, Susan Thixton has done, you know, if you go to her, I think it's Truth About Pet Food website, you can get into the gory details of this. But what that's basically saying is the picture of the lamb chop you see on the package is not what's in this product, right? What you would eat as a person is not in this food. And that's a very important distinction. And currently, there's no law that stipulates that pet food manufacturers disclose that what they are producing is feed and, in fact, not food. The other thing that's interesting is that, you mentioned a moment ago the guaranteed analysis. There's one thing that is conspicuously missing from a guaranteed analysis, which is the percentage of carbohydrate in the product. Now, one can back calculate the math to extract this number, but because it's not presented, it's not something that consumers think about. And the reality is if a cat or a dog, and for that matter, a human, never consumed another carbohydrate in their life, they would be just fine. There would be no harm because, again, gluconeogenesis ensures that conversion to glucose from proteins or fats will offer the body every bit of carbohydrate that it needs to survive and thrive. And so that's something, again, it's a little bit of a blind spot. You know, there's nothing illegal about that these are standard FDA labeling practices, but they do divert attention away from these essential topics and considerations.
Right. Yes. So as we kind of start to wrap things up, what message and it could be whatever points you want people, what do you want to leave people with in terms of what's the most important thing if your cat or dog is facing some kind of illness like the ones we've discussed, what should they be doing in general?
We can take this in tiers, right? So the first tier is kind of the ultimate tier. So if resources are unlimited or are in plentiful supply, high-resolution imaging diagnostics like CT scan and PET CT scan are so powerful, particularly when it comes to cancer, in helping a pet parent understand with specificity precisely what the state of disease is. Because, you know, palpation is a good first-order understanding of, hey, there might be cancer in this dog. Biopsy can give you tremendous information about precisely what kind of cancer it is, and in turn, what standard of care might be appropriate to address that cancer. But ultimately, imaging, though expensive, really helps you understand things like tumor load, if in fact there's been metastatic progression, and if the tumor is on an organ or close to an organ. It literally gives you a photograph, for lack of a better term, of what's going on with disease. So if a pet parent can afford to do that, that is a tremendously, tremendously valuable thing to understand because, for example, you know, no one wants to see this, but if you see a PET scan and there's cancer everywhere, not a happy thing to know, but now you know, and now you might understand, you know what, I'm not going to do standard of care, I'm going to do palliative care, and I'm going to make this dog comfortable and happy for their remaining life. If you see that the load is small and contained, and potentially an oncologist looks at those images and goes, hey man, I can do a surgery here, I can get really good margins, and this can be very successful, okay, now you might be having a conversation about something that might, in fact, deliver a tremendous amount of benefit, even though the procedure is very invasive and in many respects traumatic. So the imaging is a big deal. But, you know, maybe the easiest point of departure in all of this, and, you know, I think I'm probably just like everybody else, some of the best relationships in my life are with dogs and cats. so I don't really want those to stop. So the place that I start in all of this is to think about, you know, as their guardian, as their steward, as their companion, what can I do on a daily basis that can confer the most benefit to them? And nutrition and exercise are, I think, central pillars. And then very consistent blood work and imaging so that I always know what's going on with my animal to the degree that, you know, one can accommodate. These things can be expensive and in some instances prohibitively so. But the more consistent one is with this, if there is a problem, now you're putting yourself in a position to catch it early where you can do a lot more and have a lot more success.
That's awesome. That's great advice. That's great advice. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to share with you, everybody listening tonight, Waruba, a very, very well-known, respected, highly loved brand in the pet industry that uses human-grade quality ingredients, by the way, has offered to give away a case of cat food. So if you have a cat that you would like to give a free case of cat food to, you can go to either the Perfectly Holistic Facebook page or the Instagram page and reply to the radio show post, any of the radio show posts about this show, and just use the hashtag Weruva, Weruva, and you will be entered in a drawing to win that case of Waruba cat food. If you don't have Facebook or Instagram, you can simply email me, Pam@perfectlyholistic.com. That's P-U-R-R-R, perfectlyholistic.com, and I will put your name in the drawing. And it is going to be for United States residents, continental United States only, because that's where they ship to. So, Daniel, thank you for taking the time to educate our listeners tonight and just share these great stories. And you are just a breath of fresh air for pet parents who are seeking help and guidance for their pets who may be struggling with disease and illness, and just tying together some of the scientific research that's been done, and whether it's anecdotal or otherwise, what we're seeing that's making a huge difference with pets. And I truly appreciate you and what you're doing.
No worries. Thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
Well, maybe we can do it again sometime and we'll talk more about our beloved pets.
Indeed. Happy to do so.
Okay. Well, thank you again. Everyone, y'all have a great rest of your evening and we will talk to you next month. Have a great night. Bye, everyone.
You're listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network. Call in to live News for the Soul shows daily for intuitive coaching, readings, numerology, leading edge health information, and much, much more with featured hosts from around the world. Go to newsforthesoul.com to join the next live show now. That's newsforthesoul.com.